And then in theory, let's see if it'll work.
Alex.
See if it will work. I don't know.
I got the request to okay the meeting be.
Yep, that's good.
Recording.
And so unfortunately, for some reason, the streaming to Facebook has not worked, and I haven't figured out why it's not working. It's something strange there. Anyway, so we are recording now, and so I'll turn it over to Guy.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. This is the November meeting of the National Capital Astronomers. I'm your president for this school year. And I do want to make a few announcements, and then we have some other people want to make announcements as well. This month's Stardust looks quite good. I was somewhat delayed because of a death in the family of our wonderful editor, Todd Supple. And thank him again for great issue. I don't know if any of you have seen the Royal Astronomy Society of Canada's Observer's Handbook. I put out a notice over a month ago asking for people who are interested in getting that. If you purchase it individually, it ends up being like $44 because you have to pay for postage and the price goes up. But if you join a group purchase, it's only $26. So I have 7 members and friends who are interested in getting it, need a few more because they need 10. So text me if you want to be in on it. You don't have to send me money right now. I'll trust you for it.
Yeah, you can add me to the list.
Jay, you were on the list already.
Oh, I was. Okay.
Yeah. I've got Ted Avraham, Jim Simpson, myself, Sam Summers, Jay Miller, Elizabeth Warner, the Hopewell Observatory. So that's 7 people. So again, you can send me list in that.
Guy, if you recheck your email, you should have another one from me.
Okay, I'll add you.
I sent you an email a few minutes ago.
A few minutes ago? Okay, well, yeah. I haven't looked at it yet. Okay, thank you. All right, another announcement. I don't know how well you can see it, but
this is the current year's version, so current year's edition.
Yeah, it's full of lots of great information.
You can see it's really pretty thick here.
Yep. I put out a note about an article I'd seen in the Los Angeles Times about a barn or a building that burned down. There was thoughts it was a meteorite. Nah, wasn't a meteorite. It was something else. Announcement.
Coincidence is not causation.
Sorry?
Coincidence is not causation.
Yeah, they pretty much can rule that one out. The filter for the National Capital Astronomer.
Probably the only way.
Yes?
Oh, it's just going to say probably the only way a meteorite would cause a building to catch on fire would be if it hit a gas line.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so another notice. National Capital Astronomers owns a very nice double-stack Coronado Hydrogen Alpha telescope. It's been out of commission because one of the filters has oxidized, and they tend to do this. That happened to my own, which is a smaller one. They call it the PST. And with some difficulty, I was able to remove it and order a new one for my own personal one. And I figured out it was what the problem was with the NCA one, and that filter is now on the way. So any day now, practically, we'll get that and we can put that into business. And I think we should have more daytime observing sessions at various places. Another announcement, we still need a membership person to take care of that sort of thing. So would love a volunteer. And please, if you want to volunteer for that, you can tell me in the text box. Exploring the Sky, which we were just talking about, won't start until April of next year. And we're trying to figure out what Saturdays that will happen. We will always need people to come to those. And last one we had, which was just about a week ago, exactly a week ago, there was quite a few people came out. And the moon and the big planets, Saturn and Jupiter, put on quite a show, and it was a lot of fun. Hope to see some of you helping out next year. As some of you may have noticed, the website is more or less back up again. I don't know if Elizabeth wants to tell us any of the details, but she's been trying to transfer it over to a different server, and the new server is not doing a very good job of bringing it up to date. Elizabeth, did you want to say anything about that?
I think everyone kind of heard the info that I gave earlier. If anyone wants the gory details, I'll be happy to talk to them offline. Okay. It is something I've been working on, and yeah, getting there.
Okay. Yeah, some people just joined. But thank you for very much again for your hard work on that. I'm glad I'm not doing it. Thank you. I think my last announcement is to anybody who wants to be on the NCA email list or listserv, please text me and I will do my best to get you on there. There's somebody from a couple months ago that I tried to do that and I lost their email address. I hope that person forgives me and tries again. Okay, so any other announcements? Who was it who wanted
Jack.
To
make me?
Okay, Elizabeth did, and Jack, right?
Yeah, Jack, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Next Wednesday, November 16, the APS seniors will have the Zoom talk titled "Earth, Co-Evolving Geosphere and Biosphere, a Mineral Evolution Perspective" by Robert Hazen, who's a senior scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science. There is an announcement for the talk on page 7 of Stardust. At the end of that announcement is a link to register. You click on that and the APS will reply with the link to join the meeting. It's going to be a good talk. I hope many of you can come. Thank you.
Yeah, Bob Hazen has done some very interesting work. Okay, Elizabeth, your hand's up.
Yeah. So, Guy, do you remember which was the request made during one of the meetings? And they make the request during the chat? Because I have the chats, those get auto-saved, so I can look back through the chats if you roughly remember which meeting it may have been at.
Yeah, it was 2 months ago, and it was directly aimed at me, and I never figured out how to get back to it after I logged out.
I can get it. It records all of the chat, I'm pretty sure, so I'll go check.
Thank you. Okay, I think that's all the announcements. Except one thing, I'm giving a talk to Northern Virginia Astronomy Club on telescope making and local developments in that, and also international and national. That'll be tomorrow, as a matter of fact. I have some interesting stuff to share, I think. Okay, so John, do you want to introduce our speaker?
Yes. It's a very great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, Dr. Jens Baruch. He received his bachelor's and master's degrees in geoscience from Heidelberg University in Germany, and his PhD in cosmochemistry from the University of Cologne, Germany. Until recently, Dr. Baroche has been a postdoc at the Carnegie Institution's Earth and Planets Laboratory, working with Larry Nittler, who spoke to us in December 2019. Now Dr. Baroche is at Madison, Wisconsin. Together, they perform detailed laboratory analyses of extraterrestrial minerals and meteorites. Since the chemical compositions and ratios of nuclear isotopes in those minerals tell us a great deal about the formation and evolution of our solar system, and perhaps surprisingly about its future and about the planetary systems of nearby stars. Doctors Baroche and Nittler have analyzed grains that formed before our sun had formed, and also grains that form from what are called asymptotic giant branch stars, which are stars that have passed through a stage that our sun will pass through after it has used up all of the hydrogen nuclei, protons mostly, in its core. That will be in about 5 billion years from now. Our sun is about halfway through its life as a main sequence star. Our sun will then swell into a red giant. Not long after that, our sun will pass fairly rapidly through a sequence of stages, one of which will be the asymptotic giant stage on the sun's way to becoming a white dwarf, which is a cooling stellar ember embedded in a planetary nebula consisting of material expelled from the dying sun. So quite remarkably, these grains from asymptotic giant branch stars are from outside the solar system, and they tell us about our sun's future. Dr. Baroche.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Let me share the slides. And so I hope this works and you can all see.
Yes.
Great. And let me get the pointer. Okay. So thanks a lot for the introduction and for inviting me to talk to you tonight. You already summarized it pretty neatly. I'm not going to go into that much detail about the future. My main topic will be about a space mission that has been here, this little spacecraft here. It's a Japanese space mission to the asteroid Ryugu that you can see here in the background. And the spacecraft collected some sample material from this asteroid and brought it back to Earth. And that's what I will be talking about tonight. There are very few of these space missions so far that actually return material, unfortunately. And for the most part, we have to rely on observations when we want to explore what is beyond the moon's orbit. I understand that you are astronomers, most of you, and so you're probably pretty familiar with observation. Such as like a telescopic observation of the solar system and what's beyond. I'm always a bit jealous when I talk to astronomers. I also started out similarly with just a little telescope in my parents' backyard and trying to make sense of the night sky. But obviously your toys are a bit bigger. This year is on Mauna Kea. I had recently the chance to visit this observatory just from the outside. And then they kicked us off the mountain after the sunset so that the astronomers could do their observation and the real work. And you all know the amazing images that come from these telescopes. I also saw that you have a talk next session, I think, about the new James Webb telescope. And I hope you don't mind if I already present two of the images. I'm sure you've already seen them. They are very famous images of the so-called pillars of creation. Was always one of my favorite images taken by the Hubble telescope in 1994, I think, the first, and then they revisited it in 2014. And very nice images, but nothing compares to the resolution and the detail we can see on these new images that have just been released recently from the Webb telescope. And yeah, I think you can probably explain them much better than I can. So please feel free to interrupt me whenever I start talking nonsense. But just the very basics about these images. here you see a molecular cloud made of dust and gas. And you see two images of the same region in the Eagle Nebula, some 6,500 light years away, I think. And here on the left, this one is taken in the near infrared wavelength. And then on the right, this is the same region in the mid infrared, so a longer wavelength. On the left, you can clearly see that there are tons of stars that are clearly the highlight in this image. And they all formed somewhere in this, they all formed in this region a long time ago. And they evaporate the surrounding dust and gas and peel away the outer layers of these structures here. And what remains is where the dust and the gas is densest. And in these pillars here, there's still star formation going on, especially here, the red parts in the top, and these wavy structures surrounding it, these are ejecta from young stars. So that's why they were originally named the pillars of creation. And then on the right, you can see that the stars are, well, most of the stars are gone. So this wavelength that excels in highlighting where the dust is. And the dust will be very important for the talk tonight. Especially here, you can see where the dust is densest in these tops of the fingers, in these very dark regions. And there are stars forming that have not yet gotten rid of their cloaks, their dust cloaks. But there's also a lot of dust here in the background of the image. This red is a more colder, diffuse dust that basically blocks our view beyond like a curtain here in this image. And to see that what's happening here a bit more schematically on this slide, you can see that here, so this is basically the what we started with, molecular cloud, and then clumps or knots form where dense regions in this cloud that eventually become protostars. Then they from the infalling material, and eventually the dark gas settles around. This star is not yet, there's no nuclear fusion going on yet. This is still the early stage. It lasts for about 3 to 10 million years. And then at some point, the sun starts nuclear fusion, dust and gas is cleared from the disk, and what remains are protoplanets that eventually then grow into real big planets like the solar system that we know today. So most of the dust that was present initially here is destroyed in this process, evaporated by the heat of the sun, and then the material recondenses from this protoplanetary disk. We can actually observe protoplanetary disks like that. This one here, a TWR. Here's the young star in the center. This is an ALMA image. And then you see these concentric rings. What we see, that red stuff is dust surrounding it. And then these concentric rings, these are protoplanets clearing out a certain orbit probably. And this is how our solar system probably started in the beginning. And then eventually, after the sun really cleared out the dust, what's left is the solar system like we know it. You're all familiar with that. And except there are planets that have formed in the solar system. And there's also a lot of leftover material here, for example, in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, just boulders or small bodies. Some are larger, some are smaller, just leftover material that did not form into a planet. I have two examples here of asteroids in the asteroid belt. Here on the left, this is the asteroid Itokawa, and on the right, this is asteroid Ryugu. So I picked these two examples because both of these bodies have been visited by Japanese spacecrafts in the Hayabusa 1 mission. They went to Itokawa, brought back some sample material, and then in the most recent mission that we will be talking about more tonight, they went to asteroid Ryugu and brought back some material from this asteroid. Now I want you to look at the obvious differences between these two bodies. First of all, the shapes are different. This one here is more of a diamond shape. This one looks more like a peanut. The surface is different. There are boulders here mostly. It's a very rocky surface. Here, same for the most part, but there are some very fine areas with very fine material. The sizes are a bit different. This one is a kilometer in diameter, so not particularly large. And this one is about 330 meters, depending on where you measure. I'm not sure which dimension is which here. But the main difference between these two asteroids is their spectral types. You can distinguish them by the way they reflect sunlight. And this one here is classified as an S-type asteroid, stony or silicious. Silicious, I'm not sure if I pronounced it correctly. And here on the right, this is a carbonaceous type asteroid. It's much darker, has a much lower albedo, one of the darkest objects that we can observe. So what that means is that these bodies have very different compositions. And sometimes pieces from these asteroids break off and they come to us in the form of meteorites, like this one here. We can pick them up if we are lucky enough to find them. They are typically easy to spot in, for example, Antarctica, where there are organized searches. You can clearly see the meteorite sticks out compared to the white ice surrounding it. And you can basically find them anywhere, but Antarctica is one place to go when you want to be successful at meteorite hunting. And then you can take them home and you can put them, analyze them with any method that is available. Now, there are different types of meteorites, very diverse types, just like there are different asteroids in the belt. I will only talk about the chondrites tonight. There are different, completely different types of asteroids, meteorites. The chondrites are special because they have never been melted after their formation. And they can be subdivided into different main classes here, the non-carbonaceous chondrites and the carbonaceous chondrites. So similar to the S-type and C-type asteroids that I just showed you on the other slide, there might be some connection here between this and carbonaceous asteroids, maybe, and the carbonaceous chondrites. The ordinary chondrites here are the most common chondrites that we find on Earth. They can be further subdivided into different groups that are not really important. There are also enstatite chondrites, more groups. And the carbonaceous chondrites, there are also several groups. I think it's about 8 or 9 nowadays. There are new groups that are defined depending on if you find enough meteorites that belong to a group. Now, very important for tonight will be the CI chondrites, because they are somewhat unique among the chondrites. They have the same elemental composition as the sun. If you measure them, then it matches the composition of the sun. All the others are slightly different. On the grand scale of things, they are pretty similar, but there are slight differences. So we use the CI chondrites as a standard, and we normalize every other meteorite onto the solar or CI chondritic composition. They are also somewhat unique in that some components are different than in the other meteorites. I'll talk about more of that later. Just one example of a chondrite here, Allende, fell in the, I think, 1960s, a very famous meteorite, a lot of material that we were able to recover and study. And now these chondrites like this one, they are basically a fossil record of all the components that formed in the protoplanetary disk very early on, because they have never been melted since. So everything that we see here formed directly in the protoplanetary disk, but then was not incorporated into planets and remelted or was modified in other ways. The main mass here are clearly these little globules. They're called chondrules, high temperature phases high temperature component that formed very early in the protoplanetary disk. The white stuff here is also a high temperature component, irregular white. It's called CAIs. They are the first condensates that condensed from the cooling solar nebula. And all of this stuff is embedded in a very, very fine-grained dark matrix. Here you can it's a bit hard to see, but everything surrounding these chondrules, is basically called the matrix. And there, the matrix has not seen high temperatures, just like the components in the matrix, for example, organic material that is incorporated here, has also not seen high temperatures, otherwise it would have been destroyed. So we can see a lot of interesting components to study when we want to learn about the composition or the processes and compositions in the protoplanetary disk. Now, one component I have not mentioned yet, and these are so-called presolar grains, the dust grains that we can, for example, see here in the pillars of creation, just dust that was present before the solar system formed. And most of this dust was destroyed when the solar system formed. However, some parts of this dust survived and were incorporated into meteorites, into the matrix of meteorites. And we can study them if we are able to find them. Now, presolar grains, obviously by the name, by the definition, means presolar before the sun. All the other components that we can find in meteorites have formed from the protoplanetary disk. These were present before that. The way we identify them is by their compositions, isotopic compositions. For example, the isotopes 12 carbon and 13 carbon have a certain ratio in all the materials that we can find in the solar system. If we measure any material in the solar system, it will fall into this red range. And this is quite, there's still quite a diversity of compositions in the, within this red range that we can, modern analytics, distinguish. But then there are tiny crystals of silicon carbides that have vastly different isotopic compositions, and these fall into this range here. So this is really enormous difference. You would never, if you measure a composition here, you would never confuse this with anything that formed in the solar system. We know nowadays that there are different types of presolar grains, silicon carbides, for example, graphites. These have anomalous compositions in the carbon isotopic ratio, but there are other presolar grains, other phases that have no carbon, for example, the oxides and the silicates. So these we need to identify by the oxygen anomalous compositions. And you see a small plot here in the top left. This plot shows the oxygen isotopic compositions of presolar grains. And the oxygen has three isotopes that are important here. The 17O to 16O ratio is plotted here on the y-axis, and the 18 to 16O ratio is here on the x-axis. And here, this dotted line, this is the composition of the Earth. And then you can see the composition of the sun here. And then up here, you find something that is called cosmic symplectites, a phase that formed by interaction with heavy water, and sort of a mixing line between the heaviest composition that is seen in the solar system and the lightest composition. Everything in the solar system falls onto basically a mixing line of between these two components. But then you can see that the presolar grains, and these are oxides and silicates, for example, they have vastly different isotopic compositions, completely out of the range of what is seen in the solar system. And when we zoom out of this plot, just a little bit, this is basically this tiny rectangle here is the entire upper plot. And then you can see that these presolar grains extend massively further towards very different compositions than anything that is seen in the solar system. And based on these compositions, we can then link these presolar grains to the stars in which they formed. So every star, nucleosynthetic processes in different stars, depending on the mass and the metallicity, for example, or the type of the star. And then different processes produce different presolar grains. For example, these ones here are linked typically to AGB stars with close to solar metallicities and grains here. They 18O rich are linked to supernova explosions and so on. Here on the right of the image, you can see just this illustrates the scale of what we are talking about. These particles are extremely tiny. This one here is about 10 microns across. And this is already a very large presolar grain. I have never found a presolar grain that is this big in diameter. They exist, but they are very rare. Typically, they are maybe 1 micrometer across maximum, and usually they are a tenth of that, so just in the 100 nanometer range. And the question we want to answer is then maybe how this massive explosion formed grains like this, and what compositions they have imprinted from a supernova explosion like this. Now, the method we use to study these grains, to find these grains, is the nanosims. It's called secondary ion mass spectrometer. And the great thing about this technique is that it allows us to find the grains, identify them, and study them in situ. So still within the host meteorite. We don't have to dissolve the meteorite, which we had to do in the past. And then only the refractory phases, for example, silicon carbides and graphites, they remain. But the silicates, which are much more abundant, they are destroyed in the process. But with this machine, we can measure them still in the meteorite. There's no reason to destroy the meteorite. We can analyze the presolar grains, and we can then even analyze them with other methods afterwards, because we don't destroy it, at least not initially. It's a destructive method, but it takes some time to destroy presolar grains with it. Here on the left, you can see the nanosims image. So we made this little isotopic map of a region in a meteorite. And all this blue stuff here, this is the composition of the matrix in the meteorite that just has the solar composition, relatively homogeneous here in the 17 to 16 O ratio. And then you can clearly see that there's one anomalous blob here. And this is a presolar grain, again, with a completely different composition than the surrounding material. And in the 18 to 16 oxygen, we can see the same blob here, only that it is depleted. So this grain is 17 O rich and depleted in 18 O compared to the solar system. So this is definitely a presolar grain. And now we have the isotopic composition of this grain. And we don't know if this might be an oxide grain or a silicate grain. So what we have to do is use other methods, scanning electron microscopy, to find the same grain. And here I was able to do it. Sometimes they are much, much smaller than that and much harder to find. For example, maybe if they look like something like this tiny white blob here, then you won't be able to find them. But this one I was able to find. And with this method, we can measure the elemental composition of the presolar grain. And this one here is magnesium, silicon, and oxygen rich, which means that it is a presolar silicate. And that's how we now have the isotopic composition and the elemental composition of this grain. I would like to show you just some examples of presolar grains and how they look in the nanosims images. So this one here, for example, this is a grain, irregular outline. This is multiple phases smushed together here into one grain, very interesting one. And then here are some more examples. This is a presolar grain, anomalous in the 17 oxygen to 16 or oxygen. And here is a silicon carbon grain, anomalous in the carbon isotopic composition. And they can also be anomalous in other isotopes. For example, these two grains here, they are oxygen in, they are anomalous in the oxygen. They are anomalous in the magnesium 26, and they have also anomalous composition in the delta 25 magnesium. So this is delta, this is just the deviation from a standard in parts per thousand. And you can see that they have the same anomalous in oxygen, the same in the delta 26 magnesium, but then diametrically opposed anomalies in the delta 25 magnesium. One more grain that I'm currently investigating, this one here is identified in the SEM. And here on the right, you can see the nanosims images of this grain. It's relatively interesting because it contains here an upper grain that is rich in aluminium, and here a lower subgrain that, where the aluminium is missing. It is clearly anomalous in the oxygen, 17 oxygen rich, 18 oxygen poor, and Then if we measure the elemental distribution in this grain, you can see that this lower subgrain here is very calcium rich. There's also silicon and magnesium rich. So this is probably a silicate grain. And this is fused together with here an oxide grain, rich in aluminium, extending somewhat down here like a little tail. And then there's also a blob of titanium up here. And so this is a grain where two different grains have fused together, maybe even three with the titanium here. You can see it a little bit here. There might be a different phase up here. And then this is the rest of the grain, which is also two different grains. Now, these grains are extremely rare in meteorites. Here on the y-axis, you can see the abundance of silicates and oxides in different meteorite groups, in different meteorites. And here the abundance of silicon carbides. And these abundances are given in ppm. So that means in parts per million, very, very, very small abundances. And all these, so I want you to look at these gray data points first. All gray ones are carbonaceous chondrites that have been very well studied in the past. And you can see that they can have up to 240 ppm here in these two meteorites. But there are also some meteorites where the presolar grains are almost entirely missing down here with very, very low abundances of presolar grains. Now, the carbonaceous chondrites have been very well studied, but everyone has been ignoring the ordinary chondrites, which are much more common. And I have recently studied these ordinary chondrites. Typically, ordinary chondrites, they plot down here, like this ordinary chondrite here. So no one was really interested in looking at them in very much detail because they just don't contain any presolar grains. But then I also found an ordinary chondrite that has a higher abundance, and even one here, Semicona, that has almost the same abundances as these carbonaceous chondrites up here. And why is that? That is because you can classify meteorites based on their petrologic type. So meteorites, the chondrites, they have not been melted, but they do have experienced secondary processes on their parent bodies. So when they were on the asteroid, there was heating going on or aqueous alteration. And both of these processes modified the asteroids and then subsequently also the meteorites that originated from them. And both of these processes obviously destroy presolar grains. If you heat them up too much, then all the presolar grains are destroyed. So if you just heat it up to enough, don't even need to melt it, but if it's enough heat, then presolar grains are gone. If you have circulating fluids on the asteroid and the phases that just decomposes the phases that are present, so you also destroy presolar grains with that. Except in this case, you only really destroy the silicates. The other silicon carbides, for example, they are much more resilient. They would survive this process for much, much longer than the silicates. The silicates, they already disappear when there's just very little aqueous alteration going on. So what you really want to study when looking for presolar grains are pristine chondrites. And here you can see that only this very much the center here is fully white and pristine. Here towards the edge, there's already some alteration going on. So there's a very small number of meteorites that is really, that can be considered pristine. Most of the meteorites, they have to some degree experienced thermal metamorphism or aqueous alteration. And particularly the ordinary chondrites, this is also the case. They have experienced secondary processes. For example, Semicona is known to be very aqueously altered. So we don't really find any presolar silicates. And here, this is, for example, this is the section that I studied. And in this area, there was a TEM section taken. So that's transmission electron microscopy. And you can look at the petrology and mineralogy in a lot of detail with these sections. And it turned out that some areas of the matrix in Semicona are less aqueously altered than others. So you have fluids circulating, but not all areas of this meteorite are affected. So this matrix area here, for example, is almost pristine. And we place our nanosims maps these ones here, just in the same area where we know that it is very pristine. And we found a lot of pre-solar grains, as you can see here by these colored symbols. All of these green ones, most of these green ones are silicate grains that would be destroyed in aqueous alteration and that are missing in other parts of Semakona. If you look at the abundances of the pre-solar grains in just this area, we get 190 ppm, and that almost matches what we see in the most pristine carbonaceous chondrites, which have up to 240 ppm. And I thought that was a relatively neat result to start to present as an introduction. And hope I didn't let you wait too long to start with the Hayabusa mission here. Space missions are unfortunately very much a waiting game. Here you see it when you look at this mission overview. The mission first launched in 2014 and was obviously planned much, much, much before that. It took 4 years to arrive at the asteroid, and then the spacecraft did 2 touchdowns on the asteroid, collected 1 sample from the surface of the asteroid, and did another touchdown where they first produced a tiny artificial crater with a copper bullet and sampled some material from below the surface. And then the spacecraft was on the return journey, and in 2020, they delivered the samples to Earth. Here's a short video of the touchdown. Here you see the collector, and it will shoot a tiny bullet, a tantalum bullet, into the asteroid surface. And you will see it in just a second. So here, there's a lot of dust produced, and they collected some of this material that was just collected some of this material and then went on to the second sample. This was the first sample location, and then they went on and did the other sample where they first produced this little artificial crater. And then after the return in December 2020, right in the midst of the pandemic, here this is the re-entry of the sample capsule, and then it landed in Australia in the desert. Here's the parachute. This one here is the little capsule, and was recovered by the Japanese scientists. Here this is where the precious material is located. And then they brought it to this crazy clean chamber here in Japan, and that they built specifically for this mission, where they could open the sample container under vacuum conditions without any risk of contaminating it, and then also do some preliminary analysis of the material that they recovered from the asteroid. For example, the first phase was just looking at the particles, describing them, weighing them, measuring the dimensions, do some initial measurements like IR spectroscopy, and so on. And this phase was about half a year. First here, this is what they recovered from the asteroid. So 2 sample chambers, a total of 5.4 grams of material, which doesn't really sound like a lot, but the goal of the mission was about 100 milligrams. They would have been happy with 100 milligrams. 5.4 grams is really a massive amount. I could probably, one of these particles here, that would be a lifetime of supply if I wanted to study all of this particle with the methods I'm using. So this is really an extremely large and nice amount to do all the analysis that we want to do with them. And then after the initial curation phase, the samples were sent out to several international science teams looking at different aspects of the samples. So this was a year, about a year phase that we had time to do all the initial analysis of these samples. And different teams, the chemistry team, for example, they looked at the elemental composition and the isotopic composition of the asteroid or the samples. And then we have 2 teams looking at the mineralogy and petrology of the samples. We have a team looking at the volatile elements. And then I'm on the macromolecular organics team. Our goal is to characterize the organics on Ryugu and compare them with meteorites and understand the origin and compare them. And that's not what we are going to talk about tonight. The Prizola grains are sort of a project that we could do parallel to that. Now, this initial analysis phase was concluded in June this year, and 24 papers have so far been submitted. 8 have already been released as of 2 weeks ago. And so it's still relatively early. The first results are just coming in and being reported. Now, for the beginning, I just want to give you some results from the chemistry team that had released their results relatively early. And this here is the composition of Ryugu, the bulk elemental composition measured with different methods, X-ray fluorescence and ICP-MS. Here on the y-axis, you can see the concentration normalized to Ci carbonaceous chondrites. As I said, the Ci chondrites are often used as a standard. So we normalize everything through the Ci chondrites. So that's basically this black line here. And then here on the x-axis, you can see all the elements that they measured, and it is ordered by volatility. So the more volatile elements are on this side, the more refractory elements are on this side. And what you can see is first that the composition of Ryugu matches relatively well or overlaps relatively well with this line. So there's some indication that Ryugu is similar to the Ci chondrites. However, what's very interesting is this part of the plot. So the volatile elements have the same compositions as in the Ci chondrites too. And that is not the case for all the other meteorites. If you look at them, they have here maybe a bit higher concentrations in the refractory elements as Ryugu, as Ci chondrites. And then toward the more volatile elements, they drop down here. So they are depleted in volatile elements. And this is not the case in Ryugu and Ci chondrites. So this is the first indication that Ryugu might be somewhat related to Ci carbonaceous chondrites. The next plot here shows the isotopic composition. This is the variation in parts per 10,000, so very tiny variations, but significant enough to measure them. And you can see that the carbonaceous chondrites up here and the non-carbonaceous chondrites down here plot in different regions of this plot. And this is how this connection, or this is how this we first started to distinguish between the carbonaceous and the non-carbonaceous chondrites. So they clearly belong to either this group down here or to this group up here. And we can absolutely with confidence say that Ryugu is a carbonaceous chondrite, and it is coming from a C-type asteroid. So we can now link carbonaceous chondrites to the other C-type asteroids that we can observe by their reflectance spectra. And it is also very close to the Ci chondrites, overlaps here even with an arrow. So there's another indication that it might be related to Ci chondrites. And then the last result here from the team, this is the mineralogical composition of Ryugu. First of all, almost the entire meteorite, almost the entire sample material is consists of this very fine-grained material. There are no chondrules or CAIs. And this is very typical for Ci chondrites, the only chondrules are also missing. And if you look at this false color map of just different mineral phases here, you can see that this is all dolomite, pyrrhotite, magnetite, depending on the color here. And these are all secondary mineral phases. So the primary minerals have been decomposed by the interaction with fluids and then form these secondary phases. And this is very typical for Ci carbonaceous chondrites. And since we find the same in Ryugu, this is a very strong indication that Ryugu is actually a Ci carbonaceous chondrite. Now that we established that Ryugu is a Ci chondrite, what does that mean for the Prizola grains? Well, if you remember this slide here, Ryugu is actually all the way down here. There's extensive aqueous alteration going on Ryugu, or has been going on Ryugu So all the primary minerals are decomposed, secondary phases formed, and the precursor grains, at least the silicates, are destroyed. So we don't expect to find any silicates. The silicon carbides, as I said, they are more resilient. The oxides we'll probably also find, but the silicates should be all gone. So it's really not a good sample to look for pre-solar material because it has just seen too many secondary processes. Here's a grain that was sent to us in the laboratory to analyze it. So it's just really tiny. Even though this is really a lot of material, this is more than, this is years of study if I really wanted to study this entire particle. And here you can see an optical image. If you are interested in these images, there's a catalog of all the 1,800 grains that they recovered from the asteroid here on this website. You can find in the database, you can look through all the particles that they found and also some results, some initial analysis results linked to these individual particles. So a lot of catalogization that they have been doing. Now this particle we prepared by crushing it. And then this is here the crushed Ryugu material. And then with the micromanipulator, I selected tiny particles here. So 10 to 13 microns across. And I deposited them onto this grid here on gold foil. And here, all these black dots here are particles that I picked. And then these particles were pressed here with this press into this little mount. Here, this is how the mount looks. It's ready for analysis. And here on the right, this is how a grain looks after it is pressed into the gold foil. It's nice and flat. This is what we need for the analysis. And we did that to analyze the organics and the pre-solar grains we can do basically in the process. The more interesting samples for pre-solar grains are thin sections because you can just map a larger area and really take a good look at what is in there. So this one here is a thin section of, actually this is not Ryugu, this is the CI chondrite that we measured in just to compare the results. And that has also not been done before. So we did two new things. Ryugu samples were not being studied for pre-solar grains, obviously, but the CI chondrites also have not been studied in situ. They have been studied with other methods, but not with the nanosims. And yeah, this thin section is mainly composed of this very fine-grained material. So exactly this very aqueously altered matrix. However, there are tiny areas here, for example, just this little area, where some primary minerals have survived. So here's, for example, olivine and pyroxene that are still present in just this little small area. And just like Semakona, it seems like there might be areas that are more pristine than the surrounding matrix. So as I showed earlier with Semakona, where we were able to find much higher abundances of pre-solar grains in these areas, we now know that they might be also present in Ryugu, and there's a chance that we find better and more pre-solar grains in these types of areas. This is here how it looks when we do the nanosims mapping of just a thin section. Each of these black areas are 20 nanosims maps, 10 by 10 microns each. And then we placed a couple more in this area. And then the red dots here, these are all silicon carbides. And the green one here is an oxide grain that we found. You see mostly silicon carbides and an oxide that also was expected, but no silicates. This is how it looks here. In this particle, we found 38 silicon carbides grains and then 16 more carbonaceous pre-solar grains and at least two graphite pre-solar grains. These two here are silicon carbides. You can see them here. They have anomalous carbon isotopic composition, and they are both associated with little blobs of silicon here and here. So that's how we make sure that they are silicon carbide grains. And then the oxygen anomalous grains we can see here. This one is the only oxide that we found in Ryugu. In CI chondrites, we know that oxides are present, even though we didn't find any this time. But by dissolving samples in the past, it has been shown that some of them contain some pre-solar oxides, but they were very rare. And in this pristine area or less accuracy altered area is this one here, we found a grain that is actually a silicate. So we here's the grain and clearly anomalous composition. And then I found it again in the SEM and I measured it. And you can see that here it is associated with the green silicon. So that means that this grain is actually a pre-solar silicate, which was found in this less altered region of Ryugu. Very unexpected. Here are the pre-solar grain abundances that we find in Ryugu. First, here in the two chambers, return sample chamber A and sample chamber C. You can see that the abundances of oxides, silicon carbides, and carbonaceous grains are more or less in the same range, just like Ogay and Ibuna, which are both CI carbonaceous chondrites. So we see more or less the same abundances and can confirm that Ryugu is a CI carbonaceous chondrite. However, if we analyze these areas here in this clast that is less altered than the remaining Ryugu, we can see that the abundances of the pre-solar grain are much higher. Here's a plot of the silicon carbide abundances and just compared to literature data. And you can see here, these are our results, Ryugu chamber A and C, and then combined into Ryugu total, it's almost the exact same abundance as we found in the CI chondrites here. And then compared to literature data that is obtained with different techniques, the abundances are also very similar. So we have more or less the same abundances of pre-solar grains in Ryugu and CI chondrites. And the other chondrites, they have different abundances, typically much higher silicon carbide abundance here up to 182. Maybe these two C2 ungrouped, they have similar ranges of abundances. Now the isotopic composition of these grains, they overlap very well with the literature data. So there's nothing really unusual which we found here. This group one grains here, these are typically linked to AGB stars. And these group four grains, they are linked to supernova explosions. And we found one grain here and two grains that are here linked to the AGB stars. Nothing unusual, everything overlaps here with the typical ranges in the literature data that we can see. And these are the abundances of the pre-solar silicon carbides. Here on the y-axis, the nitrogen isotopic composition, and here the carbon isotopic composition. Again, all these gray symbols here, they are the literature data for pre-solar silicon carbides. And you can see that they have quite anomalous ranges up here and here, and even down here, we found nothing of that sort. All of these the grains that we found overlap with the literature data, but they are relatively close to, not at the very high end of the very anomalous compositions. And probably this is a problem with the technique, because we measured when we measured these grains in situ, then surrounding materials contribute to either nitrogen or carbon if there are carbon and nitrogen rich phases around surrounding these pre-solar grains. And in Ryugu, this is the case. There's lots of organic material in Ryugu. Here, for example, this is a 12 carbon map. All these bright blobs are organic materials, and all of these dark blue material, this is just diffuse carbon here in the background. And all of this stuff is nitrogen and carbon rich. The bulk composition of this material is here where the green star plots. And then these green lines here, they are mixing lines between the compositions of select pre-solar grains and mixing with the organic matter. You can see that mixing contribution from this organic material just shifts the compositions of the pre-solar grain towards less anomalous compositions and basically closer towards the composition of the organic material. And that's exactly what we are seeing here in Ryugu. Now, to conclude the talk, the major result that we have, this is the first study of Pisola grains directly on an asteroid. They have been well studied in meteorites, but now we can confirm that everything that we find in meteorites is also present on asteroids, which obviously makes sense, but it is good to confirm. We have oxides, we have even silicates that were not expected in this type of meteorite or chondrite. We have silicon carbides, we have graphites. These are the typical grain types that we can find. The abundances of the Prizola grains, they confirm that Ryugu is a CI chondrite. So they very much well overlap, and we can confirm other results from the other teams that Ryugu is a CI carbonaceous chondrite. And interestingly and surprisingly, some of these silicates survive in regions that are less altered than the rest of Ryugu. So there's quite an intriguing heterogeneity in the Ryugu samples. For example, these clusts here with less altered lithologies where primary minerals and primary phases survive. And it would be very interesting to study more of these areas and to find similar areas in the CI carbonaceous chondrite. In the future, actually I'm currently doing this. I'm studying these two grains that are from the same sample chamber, but they have different spectra here in the IR. You can see the oxygen, the OH absorption feature at 2.7, and you can see one has a much shallower absorption feature than the other grain. So we can compare them and see maybe if this grain is less aqueously altered than the other one, and we'll be able to find more Prizola grains in grains like these. So to conclude the talk, I'll show you a brief video of, if it works, let me see, yeah, of another space mission that is currently going on from NASA, the OSIRIS-REx mission to asteroid Bennu. They collected material, I think a year ago, approximately. They are currently on the return journey. Here's the time of sampling of this space mission. Lots of material that they collected. I think it's much, much more material that they will bring back than the Ryugu mission. And hopefully they will successfully land in, I think, end of next year. They should be back, and then we'll be able to compare the Ryugu samples with the new samples from asteroid Bennu. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and I hope you enjoyed the talk.
Thank you, Jens. Okay, if anyone has questions, you can raise your hand and unmute yourself. It helps if you raise your hand so we can kind of call on you so we're not talking over each other. Go ahead, Justin.
Hey, yes. I have a question about when you said that CI chondrites have similar compositions to that of the sun. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. So when we measure, the same composition except for the very volatile elements. So hydrogen and helium, for example, they definitely have other compositions. But apart from that, CI chondrites match very, very closely the metallic composition of the sun. So every metal or every element except hydrogen and helium is typically named as a metal in cosmochemistry. So the metallic composition except hydrogen and helium matches the composition of the sun of CI chondrites. And all the other chondrites, they have very similar compositions too. It's not like they are completely different, but there are slight variations that we can measure and where we can then think about, okay, what caused these variations? Why do they have slightly different compositions?
Okay, so you're saying how certain chondrites, their compositions would indicate whether they're from supernovae or AGB stars. So if something is if some pre-solar grain is similar to, if you find a pre-solar grain inside of a CI chondrite, does that say anything special about where it might have come from? Or is it specifically the grain itself that tells you where it came from?
Yeah, it's it doesn't necessarily, if it's only incorporated in the meteorite, I cannot really tell anything about the it doesn't matter in which meteorite I find the grain, basically. It might matter if I find different grains in different groups of meteorites. And this doesn't seem the case. So far, we only studied the carbonaceous chondrites, and I only recently studied these ordinary chondrites. And we found actually the same grains and the same compositions in ordinary and in carbonaceous chondrites. So it's more the grains themselves and their compositions that tell us about the processes in the stars, for example, supernovae or AGB stars. But it seems like they are relatively homogeneously distributed in the solar system. So different locations, when asteroids form in different locations of the solar system, they more or less seem to incorporate the same types of grains. And it's very early to tell because a lot more studies have to be done, but it seems like that the most pristine meteorites, no matter where they formed, they have more or less similar grains in them.
Got it, thank you.
Sue?
Yes, about a year ago, a team from Brown University, I believe, made a convincing argument regarding a 75-kilometer swath of the Atacama Desert, which has these large chunks of glass. And they found grains embedded within the glass that seemed to match what would be expected from a comet, and concluded that this area was the site of a comet airburst. So I'm wondering, given the amount of stuff that's out there, would this be an interesting source for studying these grains, or are they not pristine enough after having been through that high temperature explosion?
Well, I'm not familiar with the paper that you're referring to, but I think it really depends on the type of sample. So if there was a lot of heating, then they are destroyed. But meteorites, they fall to Earth too, and they are also heated in the atmosphere, even though it's just the outer layers that are really affected by the heating. So it depends on if they are still fresh on the inside, or if they have been heated too much, then fissural grains are unfortunately gone in these samples.
I have a question. So a couple of questions, actually. So the matrix that these things are in, it kind of looks like, you know, somebody was pouring a bunch of resin in, but I'm sure that's not what happened. How dense and hard are these granules?
Not particularly. It's relatively porous. Especially in the matrix, there's space for fluids to circulate, and then also alter the matrix. And this, especially this Ryugu stuff, you can easily crush it. And also the pressing that I showed, it's very relatively simple to press it. It's relatively soft and porous material.
Okay. So when you say, you know, the stuff is destroyed by solar heating and stuff, you know, when it's melted, I understand. But if the star destroys it, does that mean that it's just blasted out into space again?
I'm not sure if I understand. When you're talking about the
grains, the particles being destroyed, obviously matter can't be destroyed except in a thermonuclear explosion. Is it just blasted out into interstellar medium, basically?
Or what I was referring to with the fissural grains, you mean, when they are destroyed, this is specifically on the meteorites. So the phases, fissural phases, they are just very delicate, and they decompose when they interact with fluids, for example. And then secondary minerals form, but the composition is changed in that process, and you cannot study them anymore. And that's what happened to almost the majority of the dust that was present before the solar system formed, was heated up, it was homogenized, and then new stuff condensed from the solar nebula. Only these few grains survived, but then at some stage on the asteroid, they can also be destroyed by, for example, heating on the asteroid or aqueous fluids that circulate. So what means destroyed is in that case just decompose secondary phases that form, and we then cannot study them anymore.
Okay. So how does that mass spectrometer work that is totally non-destructive?
No, it is destructive. Sorry. I lost my thought in that on that slide. It is destructive. It removes the surface of the sample, but it's a very slow process. It sputters away the surface. So we can when we find a Prizola grain and we have analyzed it, typically, if it was big enough, the Prizola grain is still there. We've destroyed some material, but we can then go ahead and find it with, for example, the secondary electron, the SEM, and then measure the elemental composition, and then even go ahead and maybe take a little section of it and study in with electron microscopy. So compared to the process before this machine, where the samples had to be completely dissolved in acid, so that only the most refractory phases would remain in after dissolving the rest. And it was described as burning the haystack to find the needle. So to find the Prizola grain, you destroy everything else, and the silicon carbides, they are so, that they survived this process. But other grains that we didn't know existed back when we did that, they are destroyed in the process, for example, the silicates.
Okay.
And they are also destroyed with the nanosims, but at a much lower rate. So we have the chance to actually do more studies on them before they are gone.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions?
I have a question, if it would. Is it Dr. Borish?
Yes.
Yes, sir. And this is kind of a silly question, but I always maintain I have the right to ask one stupid question every once in a while.
Go ahead.
Okay. So on the news, you know, I'm not very educated in this particular format, but on the news, they've been talking recently about mining asteroids. And I was wondering, from your experience, how really viable do you think that is as a choice? I mean, you've seen the kind of mineral compositions that the system, you know, up close, you've measured it, you know, I suppose you haven't seen much gold there or platinum.
But you can definitely find a lot of stuff that would be worth mining. The only question is I wouldn't know. I'm not an engineer. I think that's more a question for an engineer.
I was wondering if the composition was there. That's all.
There are definitely, for example, rare earth elements that could be mined, I guess. Same on the moon. And they're even talking about diamonds that are somewhere in Jupiter. But how would you get there?
Have you seen stuff from this particular, from these samples? You talk about silicate, carbonaceous silicates, but have you seen other stuff? We got plenty of silicates here, you know, so have you seen something rare in the samples that you've gotten?
No, I don't think there's anything on these samples specifically. I don't think they are.
I know they'll realize they're small, but.
Yeah, I mean, these are only 5 grams, so.
Few atoms of gold in there somewhere.
Definitely. I mean, there's definitely rare earth elements and gold in there. I don't think that's necessarily easy to mine or in types of an ore or something. So I think even if we could access it, I don't think that's necessarily the first thing to think about when we would be able to do that. But I'm sure, there's definitely potential out there when the technique is developed to do that.
Thank you very much, sir. It was an excellent lecture. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay. Well, seeing none, I want to thank Jens for his talk, and I don't know if we can all clap our hands or however you do it electronically. Thank you very much for giving us an interesting talk.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Jens. All right, thank you everyone for coming out, and we'll see y'all next month.